First of all, we'll draw it in a variety of ways. We say that the letter that we call P is the way that we reach that hour. When we write it, we use the same letter and put a little bit on the end of it, which is like a vibrating reed. Imagine it swinging about and vibrating. Vibration sorts things out. You might have been down a coal mine and seen a vibrating coal sorter. Sort of track. And the track moves backwards and forwards, and it has holes in it. And you throw the coal higgledy-piggledy onto it, and this moving track, vibrating, shakes all the pieces of coal free, and the small bits fall through the spaces that are made by the shaking. And the big pieces stay on the top, and small pieces fall through the holes, and they go along to a series of different size holes, and so by a simple vibrating movement, all the pieces of coal are sorted out into different sizes. So this vibration is a method of sorting things out. Now when we write letter R small, we write it like this, something like a curly piece of bed and wire. And if you look at that shape and reverse it, that's the way the Hebrews write their letter R, which is resh. Now that letter resh, with a slight change of vowel to rosh, means head or chief. The head of the year would be called the rosh of the year. And that rosh is related to another word, ruach, which means spirit. And spirit again is a differentiating force. It is the formative differentiating force. When we say creation, we are implying finiting and binding. And the binding is doing two things, making one being within the limits of the boundary and excluding other beings of a different kind. And all classification depends upon this, that we bind together beings of a similar type and exclude beings of another type. So this creation itself is a differentiating process, and our best differentiator is vibration. You don't need a lot of intelligence to sort the thing out, providing you keep vibrating. If you keep vibrating, keep your mind moving, keep your ideas shifting about, quite spontaneously they will sort themselves out, providing you don't allow the mind to become static. Keep it on the move and you will see the differences that exist. If I hold up four fingers, you cannot help seeing that those fingers are not the same length. You don't have to be clever to see the difference where the difference is obvious. And vibration, continuous change of direction, forces upon you the differences of things, like the vibrator in the coal sorter causes the different lumps of coal to separate out and fall through their respective size holes. Now this letter R has an origin. The origin of it is very, very simple. It is a drawing of a human tongue, and it is the same letter, the resh, which by a simple change from the sh to the hex becomes rex, the king. And the king is he who can differentiate the elements in a situation. The man who can see all the differences is a king. This root king comes from a root Cain, Canon, modern German Canon, Scottish Canny. Know is the base of king. The king is a knowing man, a man who knows the material situation. Carlyle, analysing it, says that king is König, können, to be able. which means that Cain means Abel, that your ability depends upon your knowledge. And once Cain has murdered Abel, that his intellect has murdered faith by analysis, the only way to raise Abel again, who is crying for vengeance from the ground of the blood or feeding life, is to raise Cain. And the method of raising Cain is by differentiating the elements in the mind. Cain is the cani, or knowing principle. The resh is a vibrator, and you vibrate to make the letter R the tip of the tongue, unless you happen to be a certain type of continental, in which case you might vibrate your uvula instead, or an Arab might vibrate the back of his throat and make a sort of gullical aspirate. But somewhere there is vibration. In the original pronunciation of the word horror, it would not be pronounced with the tip of the tongue, which is intellectual, but with the very handmost part, right down the throat. So you should say horror, because in a state of horror your gullet expands, and breath comes out and vibrates all the tissues in the throat and makes a horrid noise like, if you've ever had a shock, you know what I mean. The Arabs actually have a letter to express this. And the basic idea, whether it's in the gullet down here, or in the back of the tongue, or on the uvula, or on the tongue middle, sort of slurred arm you find down south, or on the tip of the tongue against the palate, the Scottish forward R, all of these different R's simply mean to vibrate. And vibration separates things out. So, if we look at the word create, and we look at the R in it, we see another letter we're not doing tonight, plus R, which we are doing. Create starts with one letter passed to the second letter, which means to differentiate. So the differentiating letter is an essential part of this word. You notice in the word create the word eat. If we refer to Samson's riddle, which we've done before, after the eater came forth meat, you will understand the meaning of creation. Creatures are meat to God, and God reciprocally has to be meat to creatures. So when Christ said, if you don't eat my body, he's saying you're not praying prayer because I'm eating yours. We must pray prayer. Out of the eater came forth meat. The eater, or heater in the aspirate, is the absolute original fire energy, which we represent by the paper, the sentient power itself. When it vibrates, it separates into centers. As soon as I vibrate the paper, you see forms flying across it. If we make it vibrate from many points simultaneously, it will produce patterns with which we are very familiar, the patterns of interlacing circle. The center of each circle is a point of initiation of a vibration. And as long as the vibration is continuing, there will be differentiation of centers. And each center is, because it is the initiation point of a vibration, worthy of writing a letter R on it, it is a ruling center. It is the king. It is the rex for any zone of influence. And this means that the ruling part of the man is the center of initiation inside himself. If we take the first sound in the beginning of Genesis, we see ba, ra. You see? B and R. B is a glyph that we've done a bit of before. It means a house, or dwelling, or container, or being. And the R means differentiation. So bra means a place of differentiation. So the word we translate in the beginning actually means a house with differences within it. And the universe itself is such a house. If we didn't have a binding form to begin with, we'd have nothing to reflect the motions backwards and forwards inside. And if they didn't reflect, they wouldn't cut themselves to bits. But the motions inside the circle are flying backwards and forwards, continuously traversing each other, produce intersection points, zones of mutual interference. Now observe what happens. A force is going in one direction, another force in another direction. Force A, force B. Force A knows where it's going, force B knows where it's going. Force A does not know where force B is going. Force B does not know where force A is going. But at the intersection point, there is knowledge of the direction of A and B. So the intersection point of the two is a zone of heightened awareness with alternative directions. You can see then why it is a ruling center. Being an intersection of forces, it knows more than any of the constituent forces. And therefore it can choose which one of those forces to superstress to produce a change. Whereas each force considered in isolation cannot choose, it is simply itself being. In a certain sense, you might say that the lower orders of angels or angels could not do what man does. They could not choose to be other than they are. Not in the way that men can, because they are, if you like, praising God specifically, and talking about unfallen angels of mind. And because they are unfallen, they are purely what they are. And as each one of the angels is a formal principle, therefore it hasn't the same alternatives that a man has. A man is made out of the earth, fallen matter, with free spirit at the top. And he can, by identification, act like a mineral body, or like a plant, or like an animal, or like a rational man, or like a human, or like a divine being, because he's an intersection place of all those different things. Well, it means that the vibratory principle, the earth, everything comes into existence, and if we vibrate the place simultaneously from all points, we will produce zones initiated from centers, and the centers always having more information than any one of the perimeters considered in isolation. This means that the more forces you can discover inside yourself and make conscious in yourself, the greater number of directions that become conscious to you, the greater width of choice you have. Now, choice is another word for freedom. And if you haven't got the mental content, you can't choose. So if you don't give a vocabulary to a child in the choosing of the caskets, gold, silver, red, and you don't tell the child that this is gold, very valuable, this is silver, not so valuable, this is lead, least valuable, if you don't say that to the child, then the child cannot judge those things in the same way that you can, with the highly complex social and traditional value placed upon those things. Only when you become aware of many elements in that situation can you choose. If you are presented with one element only, you couldn't choose other than to reject it or to accept it, but you wouldn't have an alternative. But if there are two, Pythagoras uses the letter Y to symbolize it. If there are two, you can stand at the intersection point, you can look back where you come from, and you can look to the left and the right, and see whether the left or the right appears to contain an element in it similar to the order you've been pursuing along the line you just left. So if there are two alternatives, you can choose. If there are two at the end of each one, again, the number of choices goes up and up. So a tree with its continuous bifurcation of the branches and twigs symbolizes innumerable choices. And the universe is said to be a tree, the Yggdrasil of the Norse myth, the cosmic tree, and there are many other names for it in other systems, but throughout all the philosophies and ancient religions, the idea that the universe is a tree is presented, and the tree, as we know, comes out of a primary seed, the sphere, and differentiates, bifurcates, and grows in all directions, splitting all the way, and growing, in the process of growing, as you can see by the letter R in the word grow, vibrating and differentiating, and multiplying its possible choices. Now, as with everything else, there's always a dual aspect, there's a positive and a negative. As you are going forward along the branch lines to the trees, you're increasing the number of alternatives, but you're also getting further from base. And you should remind yourself to return to base periodically to see what is your root choice that you have made. Otherwise you can be diverted. You know, in the stories of the three sons in the fairy tales, they go out in search of adventure, and the eldest son goes, he doesn't return, the second son goes, he doesn't return, and the third son goes and finds that they both got diverted, one into a pub and the other into a brothel. And they've gone along bifurcating, looking for the truth. They've forgotten the original purpose that they had in the center, and they've been diverted, two-turned, by the alternatives presented to them, and they've finished up in a dead end. They've been sidetracked. To avoid this, you must return to base and ask yourself, what is the meaning of leaving base at all? Now, Christ puts it in the words, except the seed falls to the ground and die, it abides alone. Now, die itself means divide, and it's another form of the name of God. This D-A, and the D-O, D-U, and so on, all mean God. So the command, die in order to live, a German proverb, very popular with Germans, you die to live, means you divide in order to increase value. Then there's a seed. Imagine that's a unific seed precipitated in infinity. If it does not divide, it remains alone. Alone means all one. But if it remains all one and there is not another, then there is no possibility of evaluation, no possibility of differentiation, no growth, no increase of joy, and so on. Christ says, if he arrived, you might have life and have it more abundantly. More abundantly means there must be more of it, and more relations. To get those, the seed that has fallen to the ground must die, and die means be divided. Now, the best divider is the vibrator. Whatever the elements that have been compressed by the force of Saturn, the centripetal force, whatever they are, vibration will shake them loose. So if you get in your car and rush madly down the road, and don't use your brakes, and when you see a large lorry in front, you rush straight into the back of it, it will differentiate the car for you. The vibration will loosen everything that is not basically homogeneous. So the vibration itself is the great sorter. So we can expect that wherever we see the letter R in a word, it will signify ruling power, differentiation power, the power to see differences, and so on. If we look at the Egyptian concept of the world, we find the lower region, which is called Tum, and we find that in the east, you get a special name. His name is K-P-Ra, and this means a lock-breaking fire. The sun is going round, and when he goes over the western horizon, he goes into the darkness of Tum, the T-U-M, which when he brightens is the moot, or mother principle, the dark substance. That's just in Dutch, the final T to a D, and your mother's name is Mother. when it's gone through the darkness of the Tumland and it comes to the east point, at this point it receives a name, which means the breaking of the lock of the night by the fire which is rising up. And when it reaches the zenith, it is called Ra, the ruling activity. So the Ra in the east means the differentiator that is breaking the lock of the darkness placed upon it. And the zenith position, where it sees most, can differentiate most and makes a hot spot of differentiation underneath it, receives the name of Ra. This pair opposed, Tum and Ra, are father, mother, king and queen. Mut, Tum, or queen of night, and the Ra, queen of day. Both together as a cosmic hermaphrodite make Ra Tum, which appears in the Ra Tum of the Latins and is the origin of our word ratio. If you want to get the full benefit of the letter R, you must use it, and when you see it in a word, think. Here it must mean differentiate. And differentiation has various levels. If I shake the paper gently, certain ripples spread across it slowly, and we can see that we have time to see what then is there. If I move it very slowly, we could count the ripples as they went across. That's differentiation with a slow periodicity, easy to assimilate. And the paper itself can assimilate it. But if I speed it up, it becomes difficult to count the waves running through it. And if I were to speed it up more and more and more and more, at a certain point the natural cohesion of the molecules of the paper would give way and the paper would fall to bits. The differentiating force of the vibration R would then have reached its turn. Let's look what happens in a head case human being. There is a nuclear center, and the nuclear center is already differentiated within it. It's got chromosomes along which are the genetic factors, and it has a tension band around it that keeps the nucleus separate from the protoplasm outside. And inside that nucleus we can write psyche if we want, the soul. And from the perimeter of the nucleus to the perimeter of the protoplasm we can write soma, the Greek for body. And we can say that both together constitute a psychosomatic unity. And its peculiar characteristics are that in the soma region, the protoplasm itself, we have a quality called irritability, notice the double R in irritability, capacity to vibrate and to retain the impressions of the vibration. This is the basis of memory. Notice the R in memory, you have the grip of substance and the R, which means vibrate. Memory means that your substance is vibrating. And when you look at the vibrations of your substance, you are memorizing. Now imagine a stimulus comes from outside and the coherence power of this soma, this body protoplasm, has a certain level. The stimulus comes quite gently and ripples begin to spread through the beam. When they have spread through the beam, they are reflected back to the point of origin. If we now increase the amount of energy put in to the protoplasm, the ripples increase in their speed, and if we keep on increasing the rate of input, we can make them go in so fast that they haven't got time to get over to the other side before they'll be reflected back to the center. And we find then two motions occurring inside. One is trying to go in and the other is trying to go out. And if we increase the rate of entering energy sufficiently high, the protoplasm will not be able to assimilate this two-way motion, and it will then fall to bits. Now this can happen physically by simply vibrating the body. You may remember I mentioned this a couple of years ago. It was 18 months. About 15 monkeys in America who were killed by using a high frequency device that simply made the field of the monkey's brain fluctuate very rapidly. When it did so, the monkeys first began to look distressed, then their noses went red, and then they died. All that had happened was that the in and out movement was so fast that the substance of the brain could not accommodate itself to it. The molecules couldn't move north and south quick enough to get rid of the input energy, so they died. And that can happen with simple things like electromagnetic waves, like radio waves and so on. It can also happen in another way. Imagine you have a concept inside your mind, and that concept has within it a certain number of elements differentiated already, because it's a concept. A concept is with cuttings. The sept is cutting. A percept is where you go through the situation and cut out, in principle, one element of consciousness, one sensum, one simple reaction of a sense organ to a stimulus. Call that a pure percept. You say it's a conceptual limit, nobody's ever had one. They never get one element acting on a sense organ at one moment, they get many. But when we imagine a conceptual limit, one sense element that arises in the substance, presentation of one pure element of sense, which we call a percept. Now, if we put several percepts together because they are similar in some way, like long boxes, short boxes, round boxes, curly boxes, and so on, they're all boxes, and therefore we put them all together, take many percepts, unite them by similarity, and the term then used for them is concept. To come, meaning with. You put all the percepts together, and then you have a concept. So a concept is a highly differentiated zone of patterned energy. Because it is a finite, it has a definite limit to the amount of energy it can assimilate. Christ warns us about this. He says, don't put your new wine in old bottles, lest it burst them and the wine is spilled. The wine he's referring to is the wine of life, the life force itself. If we find somebody who's got a pet idea, that is to say they're identified with a given conceptual group, they believe, although erroneously, they believe that this concept is for them a matter of life and death. If we now proceed to take it to bits by shooting energy at it, in other words, by analysing it, they cannot stop the relevant data presented by the analyst from entering all the related parts of the concept. They haven't the power to do it, because the mind only works by association law, and that law is by similarity, by contiguity of time and place, and by causation. And because there is an element A in it, and an element B in it, and an element C in it, and so on, because of that, if the elements A, B, and C are presented in a stimulus complex, the owner of this concept has no power to stop resonance with the new stimulus. The result is, energy enters the conceptual structure, and because the energy itself is patterned, it goes into assimilation with like elements in the complex. But this unbalances the complex, the concept. Because if we have element A, B, and C inside there, and we put the stimulus A and B inside, and not C, we stimulate A and B within, and they become superstressed, while C remains dormant. Now the concept there that the man has been leaning on becomes distorted by the new energy input, And he, because he's identified with it, feels distorted too. So if you disclose your pet idea to a good logician and he's in an attacking mood, he can attack your cherished idea, and as you observe the attack, if it really is a cherished idea, you begin to feel uncomfortable, because the input physical forms will disequilibrate your pet idea. And if you're identified with it, you will suffer, that is, you'll be in passive relation to the incoming energy. Now, it's obvious that this is a dangerous thing to do for an old bottle. But again, there are two sides to every coin. There's a negative side and a positive side. The very same thing that Christ says you shouldn't do to old bottles, namely put new wine into them, he says you should do to yourself if you want to grow up. That is to say, you must discover in yourself your most treasured concept and then dare to expose it. It might need practice. You might have to do it in the privacy of your bedchamber first, and actually just write down your favorite concept and then start to analyze it with rigid logic. This is a function of the letter R. You're going to differentiate it. You have a pet idea. We'll say the pet idea is let's try one out on the paper and see what happens. The pet idea says, Christ said, a man and a woman, when they get married, they shall cleave together and become one flesh. That's a nice idea, which many young people subserve in the initial stages of their relations. It sounds very nice, you see. It's matey, warm, and secure. And it means bacon and eggs, or whatever you eat in the morning, or cold plates. Whatever it is, that's what it means. Plus a host of other things. Now, let's examine the idea. The idea is stated by Plato in this way. When you come on earth, you have come split. There was a perfect being prior to your appearance on earth, and this being was split at birth, and you are half of it. And somewhere your other half exists in the world. This is what Plato is saying. Somewhere you have a perfect mate. Now this is every young lad's hope. First, he wants to believe it. Second, he wants to believe it's born in his century and not another one. So he has a cherished idea, and this idea is cherished by millions. Now let's see whether analysis will support it or not. And this might be painful if you believe in the truth. The statement is made by Christ that in order to save women, he will turn them into men. It seems at variance with this statement that man and woman, when they marry, shall cleave together. Cleave means take your axe out and cut it up, and become one flesh. Superficially, it looks as though they get together in a mass. And he doesn't mean any such thing, because he says spirit blows where it lives, and there's no method of predicting it, and therefore he's not predicting anything about the behavior of any pair of individuals. And Plato, when he's talking about this separation of the two halves, may or may not have understood it the way young Dreamers understood it at 17 and 18 years old later. When any being whatever comes into existence, it is a definite amount of force, which we will call H, moving in a specific manner, which we will call M, and involving itself by rotation into an objective state we call M. So every being is a mass, M, of moving energy. Now, when we talk about the male and female aspects, we're talking about the energy and substance aspects of a being. But every being is energy, self-substantiated, and therefore every being is a hermaphrodite. This means to say that there are no beings that are mere half beings, but all beings are whole beings. And if this is so, you haven't got another half somewhere lurking in the world to find. Basically, as all beings whatever are made of spirit, because there is not other than spirit ultimately, God is all and the rest is function of his power, as all beings winding in take the spirit of God and substantiate it, all beings absolutely are identical. And this means that there's no reason at all why you should relate to A or B or C, essentially, more than to D or E or F. This means that the ground of relation is not that, in the naive Platonic view, that you are half a being looking for your other half. It is a statement that you are a whole being looking for your other half, which means that you have been supersessed on one aspect of your being, and it is your duty to find the other aspect inside yourself. So you are a spirit, which is an intelligent, sentient power, and you have substantiated yourself, and you have stressed yourself either on the H or the N, either on the spirit intelligence or on the corpus, substantiated body. You have done this. And you will never rest until you equalize stress. So if you're a materialist, you are bound to be satisfied until you let go of the superstress on that and put some of the energy into spiritual awareness. Which means that you don't need to get married at all. And it also means that if you do think you do, you are deceived, and that you will find that you are deceived, and over the years become progressively disillusioned, painfully. Because the elementary fact is that we are all beings of spirit, and the spirit has substantiated itself, and all beings are the same, essentially, and there is no reason why you should relate to A more than B, and the relating factor in all cases is free will, not shape of nose, shape of leg, and so on. The real relating factor is will, and charity begins at home. First duty is to marry the spirit and substance of your own being. And when you have done so, you become fit for a relation with other beings outside you, but you have no need whatever for the kind of relation that beings believe they have erroneously when they are superstressed on either term of this duality. And this says, quite simply, that every person who has ever got married to an external being is up a gum tree. And any person with any inertia thinking that anywhere at all there is any happiness to be attained in any external being without first doing something totally different, namely harmonizing the poles of one's own being, is doomed for a dreadful disappointment. And first things first, the obvious thing to do is to perfect the relation of the poles of our own being before we enter into relation with another being, unless we are prepared to accept the misery of an incomplete and unsatisfactory relation. Now this is the kind of process we're talking about. If there was an old bottle in the room, we wouldn't talk like this. If I saw a nice little old lady in a crimped black satin dress and a bonnet on, who believed that she had cherished her husband up to the time he died 58 years ago, I wouldn't disturb her. Although I know that in the depths of her soul she knows that she's misrepresenting the case and always has done. But because she has a cherished idea and has put all her energy into it, I wouldn't attack it. Because if I did, it would disrupt. If it disrupt her life, energy would spill out. And she would say farewell in a miserable state, to no good purpose, because I would not tell her anything she doesn't know already. A woman patient said to me today that she had trusted absolutely her husband in everything, and he had let her down. And I looked at her and I said, "Will you please repeat what you have just said to me, and listen to it, and tell me whether you think it's true." And she started to repeat it and stopped halfway, smiled and said, "Silly, isn't it?" You see, it was a thing that one says, sort of situational response. But no central nuclear intelligence can possibly believe it. It's a thing that one says to other beings on the outside. It is not a thing that one, in one sense, can believe at all. It's rubbish. And so, in the contingent relation of two beings, who, as a result of the primary tacit conspiracy, are busy not saying what they're up to, there develops, through identification with conceptual groups, a funny kind of conceptual relation, in which she dashes up the road saying, "I'm finished with you," and he chases her and catches her, and then suddenly thinks, "I wonder what would have happened if I had run away," and he runs away, then she chases him. And they go on like this for a bit until they get married, and there's no necessity to chase after the person to catch them, but you chase after them for several different reasons, to see where they've gone to. The point is that any cherished concept whatever, broken down, makes you feel uncomfortable. If nobody felt uncomfortable in this room when I was analysing this hermaphroditic nature and the real purpose that we come on earth for, if they didn't, I can only say they must be already enlightened beings. If there was no sensation of having been up a gum tree, or possibly being still up one, or even worse, wanting to be up one, and being determined to get up another one as soon as the present one is dead, and so on. Those things, when you examine them inside, they're too funny for words. And like Lin Yutang said, laughter lies too close to tears, to dare to open your mouth. Any concept whatever that you have, you should dare to expose. Because if you don't, you are not growing up. You cannot become free until you release yourself from identification with these concepts. Concepts of the order we've just examined, the bunk. But that kind of bunk has kept the human race in subjection for the last 12,000 years. We have a word for it, don't we? Begin with the letter R, which means differentiate and rule. And it's romance. You see? Romance. Roman is the continental word in several languages for a novel, for fiction. Roman. Fiction. The Romans are the most fictive of all people. Why so? Because they aim to differentiate a zone substantially to evaluate it. The Romans send out their military forces, they vibrate the place with their arms, shake it a bit, see what there is there. Having gone to the limits in that zone, they proceed to bring the substance for evaluation. In other words, Roman culture, so-called, a misnomer, Roman culture was simply force of arms going out as far as they could, bringing back substances and trying to evaluate them. So we find a peculiar kind of eclecticism and gathering together in Rome of anything and everything. What anybody thought was culture in any other country, as the Romans didn't know, they got one of each. And so we find a very peculiar degeneration from the purity of the Greek sculpture or the Egyptian architecture. And we find it developing to its term in Baroque and Rococo with Nelson. The point is, fiction is the basis of faction. Whenever you make a fact, you are making an act of a finiting force. This is immediately a falsification of the absolute non-dual reality. And a fiction is a little faction. It is even smaller than a fact, a fiction. It's so tiny that it hardly deserves the name existence at all. And it's unreal. And so the Roman dream of getting value by knocking people down physically and then transporting their goods and choking up the maxima cloaca in one system was automatically and logically doomed to defeat itself. They couldn't see it. This was the negative aspect of the hour in Roma. But it broke the place up. They went out and broke the place up and brought all the rubbish back, and then it broke them up. Unless we can eliminate fictions of that order, we cannot be free. So, any concept, whatever, that we've got inside ourselves, the Romans had one, the Germans have got one, the French have got one, even the English have got one. Whatever the concept is, the fact that it is cherished or superstitious demonstrates that it is wrong. Because absolutely, there can be no question of a finite superstitious allowing a complete and total harmonious relation. So, if you have a cherished idea at all, it follows that you're doing two strange things on yourself. You're creating a finite value, and you're going under the dominion of the peculiar superstitious that you have made. Once you have characterized the situation, say as A or B, and worshipped A or B, you go under the law of A or B. And if other people don't happen to like A, and they start taking it to bits, you won't flag it. And if they do happen to like A, and they don't take it to bits, but they take it for themselves, you won't like that either. So whether they like it or dislike it, it's not going to be nice for you. I know people who have actually been to a serious, if one can say so, promenade concert, and listen to what they call the music. It could be anything from the Tchaikovsky to a bit of Schoenberg, and they could say, isn't it awful that these other people are here listening to this beautiful music? It should be for us. That's can't bear that common people should be allowed to hear their favourite bit. Now this is not rare, this is usual. If they have a favourite bit, they say, let's keep it. The poor, do they have it? It's too good for them. And so on. Whatever it is, differentiation, the R function, operates again. It is selective. And wherever a finite definition is made, wherever you like anything, whatever, be it God or the devil, if you supersess them, you're immediately wrong. Even if you supersess God at the expense of the devil. Because as that man, Mrs. Dietzmar, says in one of his little exercises, to see the value of anything whatever, remove it, and see what else necessarily disappears with it. So if there is a God worshipper, remove the devil, see what happens. Now the average Roman apologist would say, don't remove the devil, because if you remove the devil, there's no necessity for God. That's a short proof. But remove the principle of division symbolized by the devil, and what do you get? Heavenly harmony? No, because harmony means differentiation of notes. What you get is absolute splurge, which nobody wants. In fact, there wouldn't be anybody there to want it. There'd just be absolute splurge, inarticulately splurging about the place. Now, remove the differentiation principle, the ruling principle, and immediately the whole thing lapses into a month eye. So that if you remove the devil, you have dispensed with the God as you define him. In other words, God and the devil are two mutually defining concepts. So again, if you have a cherished idea, you are at fault, even if the idea is what you call an absolutely good idea. If you take the idea of the absolutely good and say, I'll supersess that. Somebody says, what about the absolutely bad? Oh, well, there isn't any. No. Well, what is it that's going back looking like it? Oh, that's an illusion. That's Mary Baker Eddy. It doesn't exist. You died just the same. But it doesn't exist. It's an illusion. But this illusion is just as if it were real. One minute Mrs. Eddy is confident there is no death. And the next minute on her deathbed, she is saying, some wicked people are imposing evil thoughts upon me. They've already done it on my husband. And these very unreal thoughts are making you believe I'm dead. And I feel terrible. And this is what she actually said when she was passing into the beyond. So if you try to remove anything whatever that you can conceive, the attempt to remove it means that you're trying to put a superstress on it if it is only of exclusion. And this means absolute, total acceptance of all things whatever. So a congenital idiot exists. We tremble at becoming a congenital idiot. Does a congenital idiot tremble at becoming us? We don't know. What we do know is that, in general, he can only evaluate things in the way of the other being does. He knows only the modifications of his own substance. He does not suffer any more to himself at his level than we do to ourselves at our level. So our pity is really a mistaken case of identification and worrying in case we got like him. But he is not identified with us, worrying if he got like us. So he's really better off than we are. So if we can take the very, very worst thing, remember Jacob Burma says the worst is as good as the best, take the worst thing you can conceive and then eliminate it, and then reconstruct the universe without it, you will discover that along with throwing that out, you've thrown the baby as well as the bathwater. That the marvelous, cherished thing you wanted to retain was somehow linked with that horrible thing that you wanted to get rid of. Let's return to the marital field again. When a woman marries a man, she has a secret intent to cut the corners off him which she knows are there. She may not verbalize it, but she has that intent. And in moments of extreme honesty, she might be heard to say to a close girlfriend, or in moments of extreme anger, she might be provoked to say to him, "I thought I could change you." It's certain that that was her intent, because it is certain that he is not 100% perfect. And it is certain that she, as a biological entity, is willing perfection in the mate who is to be the father of her offspring, that she is going to parade before the eyes of all other women to prove that she is better than they are. So she knows he's imperfect. She has to impress the other ladies by her super child product, so that she somehow must carve the husband's imperfections away to make him a fit father for the things that she's going to use to demonstrate her superiority to other women. And this kind of process goes on. To pretend it doesn't go on is just to remain in bondage to fiction. It does go on. When we look at the letter R, it challenges us to clear our mind now. It's a nice letter to begin with. It says, wake up, in fact. The Spirit of God blew on the waters, breathed on the waters, in some translations, fluttered on the waters, and God said, let there be light. There is a horizontal line, imagine for a moment, it's better drawn than it is. It's quite straight, uniform, no wiggles, and utterly uninteresting. And the Spirit of God blows upon it. Immediately it starts rippling. The rippling of that is the letter R. So, an old name of light, or the zone of rippling differentiation, surviving the word Orient. This is the place of the light. First, you get the Spirit to breathe on the waters, and that makes ripples. And then you get it to change its angle a bit and muck the ripples out so that they intersect. And the more angles it goes at, the more charming the ripple forms and the result is patterns. Now if we imagine that the Spirit is blowing in all directions simultaneously, because being omnipotent it can do this sort of thing, it produces in its unstressed, that is, its unsuperstressed in the particular sense, state, an absolute chaos. That is, it produces simply motion travelling in all directions at all possible frequencies and no limiting factors. This is called the absolute light, namely chaos. The mystics who know this and who have experienced it see that this tremendous power of the Absolute to operate infinitely in all directions adds up, in effect, to nescience, to not knowing, to nothing. It is chaos. There's no order in it. A limiting factor is required. The limiting factor is the letter O. The R itself alone would just differentiate, and there'd be no restraint whatever, and the result would be an absolute chaos. There's a relation between chaos and the power from your mouth. The chaos word is used to symbolize the power. And above it is the unexpressed. It's the firmament, if you like. The pi lat, the pi ratio function that binds up, and that palate in the mouth represents it. And above the palate, there is all the things that you're not saying that you could say if you dared to say them. But below the palate in the mouth is the tongue, the resh, the rex, the ruler, the ruach, the differentiating spirit. And the tongue waggles about in the mouth and vibrates, and below the palate produces order. So you have chaos above and order below. You may remember that we said that before this world was first created, before the great ark of Noah, the United Principle of Consciousness itself, was made, there were an infinity of attempts at producing worlds, and that these worlds vanished as soon as they were produced, because they lacked the principle of persistence. And the name for those worlds, all of them you can see inside this chaotic wiggle. If you have the time to supersess it, you can draw any pattern you like by supersessing. But without the superstress, without the principle of persistence, all those worlds are grouped together under the heading of the Edomites. The Edomite kings that fabricated worlds before this persistent world was made. The virtue of this world is in its inertia, or persistence. Remember, inertia means in working. To affirm working within means inertia. What we call inertia in the physical world is the force inside the being that makes that being carry on being what it's being. And that's persistence. And in the world we live in, the walls persist for long enough to pay the rent. And they persist for long enough for the landlord to collect it, which is good enough for all practical purposes. If they were like the Edomitish walls, we would rent the house, move to where it was, and it would just not be there. And the landlord who came to collect wouldn't find one, so he couldn't sue us. And this was the state of the chaos before the persistent world that Jehovah God made. And this tells you something immediately, that this chaos itself cannot be called God as the object of a worshipper, because it pre-exists the creature, and the worshipper is a creature. So this chaos is not God, because God is the object for a worshipper. And the worshipper must first come into existence before he can start worshipping. But when he comes into existence, the letter O has appeared, that is to say, there is circumscription, the beginning of order in chaos. Now the first circumscription that appears in chaos is called the only begotten Son of God. And remember in the Gospel of John it says, in the beginning was the Word, that's his Logos principle. This Word was with the God and was a God. There are two gods. The God is this absolute chaos, which no man has seen. No man has seen the Father. That is the generative power. And chaos isn't such a bad word, really, because it means the absolute potential of all you may ever come to know, or all beings may ever come to know, past, present, and future. So that's all right. It doesn't mean just a straight mess. It means an absolute potential of all possibilities. And then there appears in it a big circle, and this big circle is monogenes. A unific generated being. This is the word that is translated only begotten. Only, onely generated. Now that onely generated being is a unity from the word go. It is the big circle
which appears in chaos in order to stop that perpetual stretching of the amateur. Stretching is a good word because it means what it says. There's a kind of hatching going on, and the crucifixion and the mysterious letter R is in it to rub it up a bit. Stretching is the sensation one gets when one has a chaos in the head. People who are very puzzled suddenly rub their fingers through their hair, because the bioelectrical potentials in the brain are very irritant when there is chaos in the brain. You can tell by the zone of the brain that does it what kind of subject they're bothering with. This one-way generated being is the Logos, which is the second God, but the only God that is the object for a worshipper. And that God himself worships a God, not as an object, namely his father, who is no object at all. And he worships him by being himself. This is very important. Christ worships God by daring to be Christ, because he has become what he is because of the will of chaos to make for himself an orderly structure which can stand as an objectification of the eternal stretch and sort itself out. The only way it can do it is not by trying to emulate God the Father as chaos, but by being itself as the super order. And therefore the rule follows that every derivative being praises God only when it is truly itself. And it doesn't matter what people say and what words they use, if they are not discovering who they are, if they are not trying to discover who they are, what are their peculiar characteristics, what are their essential contributions that they can make, if they are not trying to do these things, they are not praising or worshipping God. To praise God, to worship God, means to personally raise oneself to one's optimum, which is the figuration prefigured in God prior to the temporal process. The original face before creation that you have is already a figuration of potentials, and in the time process it is the duty of every individual to discover who he is, who she is, and having discovered it, to insist on being it. And to do other than that, and to allow anything whatever to interfere with it, is called adultery. Adultery means adding to a being that which is not proper to that being. To think that adultery refers to sexual activity is the very lowest order of application. Its highest order is quite simply anything whatever that causes a being to become other than it really is. That is adultery. And it is that that Christ talks about. He says, if a man merely looks at a woman with this intent, he has already committed adultery. What does it mean? He's not being himself. If he looks upon her with desire, it means that he thinks she's got something that he has not. And he is going to add from outside something to himself. This is not a question about sex now. It's a question about real adultery. The man has made the error of thinking that she has something outside that he can add to himself to complete himself. He thinks he needs something on the outside. There is his adultery. It's nothing to do with the so-called ratification of the physical sex act. It has to do with the fact that he's gone off center. He's left himself, he's unbecome his real potential, and thrown himself for his satisfaction on an external being. And this is his crime. It wouldn't matter for a moment if he jumped in bed with all the ladies around the world, say about half of 20,000 minutes, providing he did not extrovert his attention and believe that they were adding something to him that he hadn't got. Well, that's very difficult. Muhammad knew the difficulty of it when he said, four wives is three more than you should have. But you can have them if you can treat them with justice, which is impossible. That's the Muhammadan rule. Every man is allowed four wives providing he can treat them with absolute justice, which is impossible. And that room is a good room because it tells you that you spend so much time externalizing your attention, trying to equilibrate the external situation, that you would undoubtedly be deficient in balancing your internal situation. Kierkegaard points out about the hermit that he could go on the top of a bus. Providing he is centered in himself, he's in the hermitage. But if he is not, even if he's inside the cloister, if his imagination is out of the cloister, wondering what's going on in town, then he's no hermit. So the true unspotted is the one that is homogeneous. Now it doesn't matter what the substance is, whether the substance is all black or all white, providing it has nothing other than itself, it is immaculate. It is unspotted. The Immaculate Mary means the unspotted substance. Supposing we draw the Chinese symbol of Tai Chi, and we have a dark half with a white spot in it, and a light half with a dark spot in it. Now they're both committing adultery. Because the black substance has got a white dot in it, it's spotted. And the white substance has got a black dot in it, that's spotted. And the whole thing itself has this dialectical possibility within it of spotting itself both ways. Christ can do this, and therefore of the animals in the medieval Book of Beasts, we find specifically that he is the leopard, the spotted fellow, also called the pantherian or all animals, because there's a dialectical trick here, as in everything else. If the relation of consciousness of every being requires a differentiation factor, then one cannot be immaculate. We have said that a being knows only the states of its own substance, only the motions of its own substance. If the motions of the substance of a being are continuous and not other than themselves, then there is no awareness whatever, because there is no differentiation. So if you are absolutely pure and there were not any otherness inside you, you would not know that you were pure. And therefore you need something to adulterate you, to force you to become aware of what you are, so that you can reject the adulterating elements that made you aware of your purity. That's a difficult dialectical trick. First, you are pursuing purity. But if you have it to begin with, you don't know you have it until you lose it, until it's spoiled, spotted. When it is spotted, the spots irritate you and make you realize that you must not adulterate yourself with spots. The spots then have a function to force you back to your purity. But if ever you lose the spots, you will lapse into unconsciousness of your purity. Comes with the symbol of the Chinese we have here. The symbol says, be pure and keep a spot to remind you of it. Now everybody is pursuing what they commonly believe in their indefinition to be perfection. And they have a vague feeling that it consists in somehow being integral with oneself. One must attain perfect integrity, perfect unity, perfect harmony, and so on. And this is the driving concept somewhere over the rainbow. Everything's going to be hunky-dory. And this concept drives men towards it. But if ever he attained that strange thing, he would need the irritant of imperfection to make it worthwhile staying there. Now this again hits at a very cherished concept. It says, if we can assimilate this lesson in one go, we can carry on being exactly what we are. Saying that all the adulterating elements inside ourselves are good for us because they remind us of our potential purity and cause us to keep it as a value. Now this dialectical twist is in Isaiah and in all the statements about the Messiah, that somehow this most perfect being comes in as highly spotted and is rejected by men in consequence of his spotty nature. All the imperfections of the Messiah defined in the OT are those very, very things that reject other people and thus allow him to be himself. Whereas if he displayed his splendor, they would all cling to him. They would be the spots, because he would then be the perfection that they wanted, and he wouldn't be able to move. You find that even a very, very finite power like a pop singer can have his buttons torn off by teenagers. When they see perfection, they want a bit. And consequently, we know that pop singers have been ragged by excited perfection pursuers. And it might need a cordon of police to keep the perfection of Elvis Presley intact. Now imagine what would have happened if the Messiah came, shining 100% pure. What would have happened to him if he suddenly arrived in Palestine on a market day? Certainly he would have been divested if he'd have had anything on, which of course he shouldn't have, because that would have been adultery. But certainly he would have been spotted by the tremendous pressure of bodies in the distance trying to get close up, so that all those that were near to him would have been pressed very forcibly against him. And no doubt they would probably not all be properly washed, and he would have got quite dirty in the process. Certainly the perspiration of the scramble would have caused some admixture if it was only perspiration. Now to avoid all this and keep himself pure, he presents a dirty facade, which the Old Testament defines very nicely. He appears in this guise in order that he might be despised and rejected of men, in order that he might retain his essential internal purity. See, when we use the letter R, we're differentiating, and we are cutting the thing to bits, and we're analysing it, and in so doing we're striking at the root of any concept whatever. And if we happen to cherish a bit, that is, if we've got a preformed conclusion, a prejudice, if we have a feeling bias of this idea or this idea, we're going to feel funny, because that letter has the power literally to rip everything to bits and reduce it to prime elements of, if there be such a thing, ultimate ether. So it's a very powerful letter. The statement, as far as we're concerned, for practical purposes, says the virtue of the letter R for us is this: we must use it to tear ourselves to bits, to differentiate, to vibrate ourselves, to disclose to ourselves whatever we conceive, no matter what it is, to be of value. Whatever it is, tear it to bits, throw it away. That's the function for us. The function for our relation with other beings is to differentiate very carefully, so that we know where other people's tender spots are, in order to avoid doing to them precisely that which we are trying to do to ourselves. So the very famous Rabbi Hillel before Christ, who was famous for saying things that look like quotations before the fact from the New Testament, he is famous for his love and mercy and so on, and for his hardness to himself. He was as hard to himself as he was soft to other people. He knew what he was doing. To everybody else, he used his ruach spirit to detect where they had tender points and to avoid them. And the same thing in himself, he used to detect tender points to hammer them. And that is the real value of the understanding that the letter R means power to differentiate and therefore to rule. One can only rule oneself when one accepts the total differentiation of all the possibilities of one's own being. And every being is ultimately a sphere, and therefore the absolute potentialities of all beings are identical. And therefore you can afford to analyze yourself completely and not following anybody else, because you have a complete universe inside yourself, which means quite literally you never need to see another human being again ever. If we like, we can all go away to separate desert islands, carry on there using nothing except a little vibrator and we'll sort ourselves out much more efficiently in less time than we are likely to do mixing with other people and waiting for them to stimulate us in the way we would like to be stimulated in order to improve.